from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's be honest, some of you are going to laugh at the Creation Museum we'll describe in the show today. You've probably heard of it. It's in Kentucky. It's been described as a religious Disneyland with gardens, a petting zoo, more than 150 exhibits. And the idea is to prove God literally created the earth in 6 days, less than 10,000 years ago. That animals in the Garden of Eden were vegetarian, that humans were around with the dinosaurs. So some of you find that funny or horrifying, but the scholars William and Susan Trollinger say dismissing the museum is a mistake. Today in the program, they'll join us to explain why. The museum, they argue, is trying to prepare and arm millions of Americans for the culture war in America. Join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The people who designed and built the Creation Museum in Kentucky, this massive, complex, 75,000 square feet, these people love dinosaurs. You see them everywhere. And what you figure out right away if you go is that the dinosaurs in the dioramas and on the placards and in the bookstore are making a point about the fossil record. Those bones being dug up by paleontologists, the museum claims, are not tens and hundreds of millions of years old because the Earth is not more than 10,000 years old. So dinosaurs lived here on the Earth with the humans. And it's easy to laugh at this and some of the seemingly absurd claims made at the museum, like the idea that animals in the Garden of Eden were vegetarians. But the scholars Susan and William Trollinger say the museum is not some wacky outpost on the fringe of American culture. It's situated right in the middle of American culture, or one part of American culture anyway. And in their new book, they write, "The Creation Museum exists and thrives not because it's so preposterous, but because it represents and speaks to the religious and political commitments of a large swath of the American population." So we're talking about their book today. It's called Writing America at the Creation Museum. Susan Trollinger is a professor of English at the University of Dayton and the author of Selling the Amish, The Tourism of Nostalgia. William Trollinger, professor of history, also at the University of Dayton, author of God's Empire, William Bell Riley, and Midwestern Fundamentalism, both joining us today from a studio in Dayton, Ohio. And Susan and William Trollinger, welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to be here.
Okay, let's start with what got you thinking about this, writing a book about this museum and your observations of the museum. Where did it start?
It started a number of years ago when we became aware that the Creation Museum was under construction. Answers in Genesis, their parent organization, had a website that would keep interested folks informed in the progress of fundraising and building the museum. And since Bill's expertise is in the history of American Protestant fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and mine is in visual rhetoric, it seemed like a rather wonderful opportunity for us to explore the range of arguments and appeals that are made at this museum. Writing the book was actually not something we intended to do. Bill was invited to give a presentation at a church, actually, about
It was about evolution or anti-evolution, and I went for the anti-evolution route.
And we decided, well, let's go down and visit the Creation Museum and put a presentation together. From there, we gave a few conference presentations, and in response to one of them, a good friend of ours said, you know, this should really be a book. And that was really the first that we even thought seriously about an extended project.
But at what point did you identify a theme going on at that museum? I mean, beyond it being, I mean, it's goofy. For a lot of people, are going to find it absurd and silly and a little horrifying. But when did you identify sort of a bigger theme? Because one of the themes that you do get at it early on is that this is not something that people should just titter at and dismiss.
Actually, we... we got onto the theme in the very, very first visit. The museum really isn't subtle about the culture war.
Yeah.
You just have to have your eyes open to see it. So they have this graffiti alley where they discusses sort of the decline of American civilization. And on the walls are clippings from newspapers and magazines. And if you take a close look at the clippings, and we did the first time we visited, you see things like gay marriage and Christianity thrown out of the public schools and so forth. And they're all kind of plastered on the wall. And you understand that the decline of America is very much connected with these sort of cultural themes in America, a cultural decadence that is the result of America's unwillingness any longer to stand on the authority of the Word of God. That's their argument.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to see it. So the museum, there is a lot of stuff in there that seems preposterous.
Yeah.
You have children and dinosaurs playing together or nearby. Of course, that's preposterous. But the darker theme is present if you're paying attention and if you slow it down, which is what we did. We took our time. We visited seven times to get a real picture of what they're doing at the museum.
You've described it as kind of an aural and visual overload. tons of stuff, I guess. Tons of things to see and tons of questions being asked. I mean, it seems like a kind of intense experience, yes?
It certainly was for us. Each time we went, we just kind of came out sort of overdone, right? Kind of one of the ways we described it was we felt like our brains had been dropped into a blender and they hit frappe.
Yeah.
It is rather overwhelming. And it's because you have there's flat screen videos, you know, here and there. There's constantly like a voiceover that's talking to you about what's happening in the Garden of Eden. There are placards everywhere. It is just rather overwhelming. And our argument about that is that is somewhat disorienting for the visitor. But that they're very, very effective, nevertheless. So as you're overwhelmed and disoriented by all of this information that's coming at you, they're also giving you a very simple narrative that makes sense of all this chaos. And we think that's very persuasive.
You write in the book that all museums, just like the Creation Museum, they're rhetorical. Their purpose is not neutral. The idea is to be persuasive, to persuade people. So explain how the Creation Museum fits in with others in its form. These interrogatives, for example, these placards which ask questions, it seems like one of the techniques that they're using.
Well, so if I can, the modern history or science museum emerges in the late 18th, early 19th century and employs what you might expect within modernity, which is a grand narrative, a big story, to organize all of the information that is presented to the visitor. And one of the ways it does that is by designing a unidirectional path that the visitor is to travel along through the museum.
Right.
Within early modernity, the big narrative at the time was Darwin's, right, story of evolution and adaptation and progress. Interestingly, here at the Anti-Evolution Museum, you have a very similar strategy underway where the visitor moves along basically a unidirectional path through the main portion of the museum. One of the things that we found troubling about that particular path is that the story that they tell is a story of that human beings are presented in the Garden of Eden, right? They're presented with God's rules for obedient living. Human beings, of course, being human, are going to defy those rules, and when they do, punishment follows. And that is the basic narrative that the visitor encounters again and again in the museum. And so Bill was referring to Graffiti Alley, same kind of thing. Can't you see, right? They're saying to the visitor, can't you see that American culture is in this precipitous moral decline, and God will make us pay? God always does.
Okay, let's back up and talk about some of the fundamentals that you lay out, fundamentals about fundamentalism. so we can get sort of our bearings on this story. Let's start. You pegged the beginnings of this kind of this brand of fundamentalism to the late 19th century, I guess it is. And in some ways, I suppose it was connected to Darwin and his, you know, emerging findings in science on evolution. Darwin starts to challenge this traditional understanding of the Bible. And at some point in the process, you have Christians who are able to see the Bible as an errant document. But others, the fundamentalists, wanted to hold tight to it. Would you just sort of just give us a sense of sort of this fundamental view that starts to emerge that you write about in your book?
In the middle of the 19th century, there were two challenges to what you might call Orthodox Christianity, or challenges to Orthodox understandings of the Bible. One, of course, is Darwin. It raises questions about all sorts of things. It raises questions about the Genesis account of creation, mm-hmm. but also raises questions about God's involvement in the life process and God's involvement in the creation of human beings. How does evolution fit with that?
Right.
The other challenge that's equally as important, actually, is something known as historicism or higher criticism that raises questions about the Bible as a historical document.
Right.
Once you begin to look at the Bible as a historical document, not as a supernatural document, you start asking questions. What about these inconsistencies? Isn't this an error? Why do we see similar stories or similar accounts from different civilizations? Now, some, as you rightly point out, some Christians, and we're focusing on Protestants here.
Sure.
Some Protestants were quite able to adapt to that. This didn't seem a problem, and they were able to make adjustments and understand the Bible as still even an inspired word, but not a perfect word, that there might be errors or it's human. It's human. That's the key point, that it's a human document. But other Christians were not willing. I don't know whether they were able or not. We'll say they weren't willing to make that adjustment. And so you see the beginnings, what I would call proto-fundamentalism in the late 19th century, and the key doctrine for fundamentalism, the doctrine, is the doctrine of biblical inerrancy.
Right.
The idea that the Bible is inerrant, it is without error, and it is factually accurate in all that it talks about. And this is late 19th, early 20th century, and after World War I, this proto-fundamentalism becomes a fundamentalist movement, which is still with us despite all the predictions. Every decade there's a new prediction of the decline or demise of fundamentalism. It's not going away. Mm. And this movement has been going on for about a century, and creationism in various forms has been at the heart of this fundamentalist movement and remains so.
Yeah. I want to spend some time with the idea of creation, what they mean by creation. But before, let me just get a sense of how fundamental these people are. So they see the Bible as being without error then. So just take the Adam and Eve story as an example and how that's reflected in the Creation Museum. So the idea is you start with two people, which means – if you're thinking literally about all of this, there has to at some point be, incest to make it work. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. And the Creation Museum is not doesn't hide that fact.
Yeah.
In fact, there is a large placard in the museum that makes that clear. And across from it, actually, I'll never forget the first time we went through the museum and we saw that placard. And we were kind of looking for it because so often the question that is asked of fundamentalists is, where did Cain get his wife? Right? Mm-hmm. How do we make sense of that? Right. And so, sure enough, they have an answer to that question, which is, Cain would have had a sister. And then when you turn and you look across the aisle, here's this domestic scene. It's this very warm kind of post-fall domestic scene where Adam is in the garden cultivating the vegetables and Cain and Abel are helping out, you know, helping him do that work. And then you look over to the right and here comes Eve descending the stairs and she looks like she's, you know, a good 8 months pregnant.
Yeah.
And it's just, we about, you know, fell over, right? That wow, gosh, there is apparently his sister.
Yeah. So I guess the question I had about that is, I wonder what you make when you, in your conversations with theologians, for example, who are not evangelical, because we hear that perspective in the book from time to time. This idea of being so slavishly tied to the idea of these literal concepts, is that a fairly modern phenomenon, do you think, in terms of Christianity? Have you been able to learn that in your exploration of the Creation Museum?
It is modern. Pre-modern Christians would take the Bible as true, but they weren't obsessed with both either the details. For one thing, they were quite willing to read certain passages allegorically or metaphorically or whatever, but they were also not trying to line up the biblical text with history or with science or some kind of reason. They weren't working out the question about Cain's wife. That wasn't the focus. But in the late 19th century, with this sort of response to Darwinism and historicism, they began focusing again on this biblical inerrancy. And the argument being, it sounds very scientific, that if you follow the correct method, what they call in some circles historical grammatical method, you know what the Bible means. If you just follow this, it's very clear. And all this becomes apparent at the Scopes trial in 1925, when William Jennings Bryan made what I would call the poor decision to get up on the witness stand and let Clarence Darrow interrogate him.
Right.
And Darrow went after all of these sort of issues I would call like the village atheist questions.
Right.
Darrow posed them for Bryan, right?
Yeah.
He said, where did Cain get his wife?
Yeah.
He said he quizzed him on the 6 24-hour day creation.
Mm-hmm.
He quizzed him about the story in Joshua where the sun was made to stand still, things like that. And these folks, now I'm talking about Answers in Genesis, the contemporary fundamentalists, in some way are trying to respond to as many of these village atheist questions as possible. And it's more important for them to respond to the village atheist question, like where did Cain get his wife, try to respond to it and give what they would consider a logical answer, than to be concerned about the implications of legitimizing incest.
You say in the book that when people today refer to creationism, they don't mean the creationism of the early fundamentalists, that it has changed. And I found this really interesting. And you track this change to a person who, ironically enough, wasn't a fundamentalist, Ellen White, of the Seventh-day Adventist group. Would you talk about that?
Yes. It's a great story. So the early fundamentalists, just to back up, the early fundamentalists were creationists, which meant they threw out mainstream biology. They threw out Darwin. And so at the Scopes trial, this is William Jennings Bryan. He is an early fundamentalist. He's rejecting the notion of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But they held on to mainstream geology.
Yeah.
That is, they held to an old earth. And this held sway in fundamentalism and evangelicalism until the 1960s. But as you're making, as you make reference to, Ellen White is the prophet who founded the Seventh-day Adventists. And she has a vision in, I think, in the 1870s. She has a vision where she sees the world being created in 6 24-hour days.
Right.
And she also sees that it's Noah's flood that creates the appearance of the old earth. This is White's prophecies, these visions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, early fundamentalism is not paying attention to Ellen White. She's a heretic in their views,
right.
In their view. They're not paying attention to her, but her disciple, George McCready Price, is developing. He follows this and develops this whole notion of flood geology, and he writes lots of books about this.
Yeah.
And his ideas start seeping into American fundamentalism and evangelicalism, especially after the Scopes trial. And so in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, this is seeping in. But it doesn't become mainstream until 1961, when Henry Morris and John Whitcomb produce the book The Genesis Flood, which we would argue is one of the most important books in 20th century American religious history. Genesis Flood, 1961, and it's basically warmed over George McCready Price, except geared to an evangelical and fundamentalist audience. They do their best to hide their connections or their indebtedness to the Seventh-day Adventists and to Price. They do their best to hide that, but it is very much Price's views with one key distinction. White and Price accepted that idea of an ancient universe. They didn't address the question of the age of the universe.
Right.
But Morris and Whitcomb say it's not just a young Earth, it's a young universe. So it's interesting. The focus is on when people talk about young Earth creationism, we talk about young Earth creationism. But to be honest, it would be more accurately described as young universe creationism.
Right. Right.
So now we have the rejection of mainstream biology, mainstream geology, and mainstream astronomy. They're gone.
So the older fundamentalists they didn't need an explanation for the fossil record because they figured a day in Genesis, when Genesis
yes.
says a day could be a million years, it could be 2 million years, whatever that meant. They didn't
yes.
really care about that. But today's fundamentalists, they're quite literal. They see the Earth as 6,000 years old, six consecutive days it was created in.
Yes, that's right. The only that's absolutely right. The older fundamentalists were quite content with mainstream geology. My father, by the way, was a geologist, and he was an old Earth creationist. I grew up with this, but when Genesis Flood hit. I grew up in Denver, and when Genesis Flood hit, my father went crazy, visiting churches and the like, arguing against the Genesis Flood because he had a fundamentalist theology, but he could not bear this young Earth creationism. But my father's battle against that not only lost in Denver, it lost throughout the United States. Today, creationism, when you use the word creationism, you generally mean young Earth creationism. There's one other thing I want to add about literalness, which is really important. There is no one literal reading of the Bible. So the old Earth creationists understood that they were taking a literal approach to the Bible. They understood that. And they argued that day could be legitimately read as a large period of time. This group of creationists, the young Earth creationists, they're not perfectly literal either. We mentioned this in the book, that they are vulnerable themselves to being charged with not being sufficiently literal.
Yeah.
Because there is this geocentric creationism that argues that if you're really going to be literal, if you're really going to take the Bible literally, then you need to understand the Earth at the center of the universe. And they are sniping at the young Earth creationists for not being sufficiently literal.
Wow. So this is, I guess, what you both mean when you talk about there being a kind of potential threat here. The old school fundamentalists could see their way to allowing geology, astronomy to be taught in schools, whereas this new brand of fundamentalists seem entirely hostile to the idea of science. Yes?
No. Go ahead.
In fact, if you happen to catch the famous debate between Ken Ham and Bill Nye, Ken Ham is remarkable. Ken Ham is the CEO of Answers in Genesis and really runs this whole project at the Creation Museum. And in that debate, I mean, he was very focused on positioning himself as somebody who embraces science. And so he said the word science 2.5 times more often than Bill Nye, the science guy, which was kind of amazing. And then at one point at the end of his first speech, he just sort of announces that, he loves science. So it's complicated in that on the one hand, Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis are all about being, you know, embracing science as a discourse that can, in their language, confirm a biblical creation, even as their view of young earth creationism, as Bill was saying, renders extremely suspect mainstream science of various forms.
Right. Right. I said that question wrong, because you make a distinction, and this new brand of fundamentalists make this distinction between observational science and historical science, which we'll get to when we get back from a break. Susan Trollinger is with us, professor of English at the University of Dayton. William Trollinger, also a professor there, professor of history. They are co-authors of the book Writing America at the Creation Museum. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about this museum in Kentucky committed to disproving evolution. It's the Creation Museum. It's massive, 75,000 square feet, 150 exhibits. And the idea is to show, and I'm quoting here, God created the universe in six consecutive 24-hour days less than 10,000 years ago. Our guests, the scholars Susan and William Trollinger, say it's tempting to poke fun or dismiss the museum, but in their books, they say that's a mistake. They're with us to explain what the museum tells us about American fundamentalism and why we should be paying attention. The book is Writing America at the Creation Museum. Well, let's talk about Ken Ham. He's a fascinating character in the story. Born in Australia, got his biblical ideas from his fundamentalist father, I suppose. Talk about Ken Ham.
So Ken Ham was a science teacher. His father was a fundamentalist. He was teaching science in Australia. He came across the book, The Genesis Flood. To make a long story short, he got very involved in sort of creationist evangelism. And in 1987, he ends up here in the States, where he has basically remained ever since. He has been a powerful creation evangelist. Mm-hmm. And in the mid-90s, he and some others created this organization, Answers in Genesis. And their first goal, their side spreading the word about young earth creationism, their first goal was to build a creation museum. They chose the Cincinnati area because something like two-thirds of the American population could get there pretty easily to the museum. And that was their goal, to build a museum. And there were hurdles of various sorts. But by 2007, they had pulled it off. Mm. Ham is both a very effective evangelist of young earth creationism. And he also has organizational skills. And Answers in Genesis, this organization that he built, is really a creationist juggernaut.
Yeah.
And they do all sorts of things besides run the museum. He has become a force in that wing of American fundamentalism.
Yeah. You mentioned seminars and debates and books and magazines. Explain how the fundamentalists you've encountered at the museum, how they talk about this idea of belief and faith. Because there are people who believe in God and are willing to concede that it's a matter of faith, that you can't prove it. But that doesn't sound like these people. Would you just talk about that, the idea of proof, how important this idea of evidence and applying their brand of science to all of this works?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And we point out in the book in a couple of places that, you know, none of this like huge apparatus of science is really necessary. Ken Ham can simply say, look, you know, the Bible says God created, right, the heavens and the earth, and just go with it. That would be a perfectly acceptable faith response. But instead, they mobilize this gigantic discourse of science and also their you know, evidence from the Bible is really important too. And to, as you say, something like prove that they're right. That in that sense, again, it's a very modern project, because for them, faith is not just believing in something or having a conviction about something, but it's about having certainty.
Right.
And that's a very kind of traditional modern desire to not just have an opinion or a belief, but to know for sure that you have it right. And so they, I think, in part, they're working against feelings among their constituents that, well, you know, maybe science does have it right. And gosh, you know, mainstream science sure is compelling. Maybe that makes me stupid if I don't believe what science says. And their answer is, you don't have to believe in mainstream science to have certainty. We can provide you with an alternative science that gives you the same certainty and allows you to be aligned with God. And so this is their deep investment in providing what they would argue is a lot of scientific evidence on behalf of their claims.
How did they see that distinction between observational and historical science? That seems an important distinction for them anyway.
It is an absolutely crucial distinction. The distinction is that observational science is true science, real science, because it is the kind of science that happens in scientific labs or out in the field where a scientist encounters some phenomenon, observes it, maybe a process that's underway. Those observations are repeatable and thereby can be confirmed by other scientists. That, for them, is real science. It's based on a 19th century notion, Baconian notion, of what real science is. Mm. Historical science is something else. Historical science is any time a scientist or anyone else draws conclusions about things that happened in the past that are not observable and not repeatable. So, and their big example there, of course, is evolutionary processes.
Yeah.
The argument being that scientists cannot observe evolutionary processes that were underway millions of years ago because those processes are over. They are locked in the past. We have no access to them. And so the best that an evolutionary scientist can do is to kind of speculate or theorize what might have happened in the past. But that's not real science. So what's crucial about that is that what they're doing, of course, and they're very explicit about this, is that they're arguing that evolutionary science is on the same epistemological plane as creationism. In both instances, you have people who are making inferences about processes that occurred in the past and cannot be repeated or observed. So this is how they make evolution look the same as creationism, right? And then thereby dismiss evolution as just, you know, something people made up, like, you know, to try to explain stuff in the past that they really don't know anything about.
Right. It's interesting, too, the way Ken Ham and some of the other people you talked to, one of them is this person by the name of Bob Gillespie, and you go to this workshop or this seminar where he speaks. And Bob Gillespie said he tried to explain that people who don't believe in this have what he called a heart problem. And in the sense that not that they have, heart disease, that they're not following it with their hearts. And I wanted to ask you about this because you say that there's this idea among young earth creationists that it's so obvious that the only ones who do not see the truth are the evolutionists, and they don't see it because they don't want to obey God's rule. So explain how they perceive people like Bob Gillespie and Ken Ham, how they perceive people who don't believe this, what the problem is.
That's a great question. And going to Bob Gillespie's presentations was fascinating for us because we wanted to see how this was presented at the local level.
Yeah.
And Bob Gillespie is one of many AIG Answers in Genesis evangelists who goes out and speaks to local churches. Your really good question actually goes back to biblical inerrancy. If you believe that the Bible is literally true, factually accurate in all it says, it's God-breathed, then the question is, well, that doesn't mean very much unless we can know what it means. We have to know what it means. And so the idea is that the Bible is clear. It's understandable. And so you can know what it means. Well, then what do you do with people who do not agree as to what the Bible means in this way or that way? Well, the answer very quickly becomes an ad hominem answer. It's got to be something wrong with them. It's sin or it's rebellion. It's something like that. And young earth creationists, and your example of Gillespie is exactly right, this is how they proceed. Gillespie says, look, it's very obvious. It's obvious in the Word of God and in the world of nature that we have a young earth and a young universe. This is obvious. You could see this. It doesn't take much. In fact, Answers in Genesis has like a 5-minute video that supposedly destroys all arguments for evolution. It's just so obvious. That's the point. So if you don't see it that way and you're arguing that it's so obvious, you have to explain why people disagree. And their answer is sin, something like sin, a proclivity to sin, an unwillingness to obey God's authority.
And this takes us back to something I was mentioning earlier about the narrative in the museum, that fits perfectly within this larger narrative, that God sets out what are obvious rules of obedience, but it's humans who are just bound, they're just bound to defy God. God encounters this again and again. We see this again and again, right, throughout the Bible is their argument. And so this shouldn't surprise us that once again we have an example of God is quite obviously and in a straightforward manner presenting us with his truth. And we, too many of us, right, fail to believe it and obey all that it means. Like the earth is, 6,000 years old, that sort of thing. And so this is part of our looming, a judgment by God, is that once again, we are defying God's obvious commands and failing to believe and act accordingly with his commands.
One of the last sections of the museum I want to get to when we get back from a break, it's what they call the Last Adam Theater. And they show this film, 15, 20-minute film, and I want to ask you about, because it gets us to this idea of judgment. And what I have to say is this kind of surprising insight in the book, that even though there's this sense that these are Christians, obviously, clearly they are, you don't have a lot of Jesus in the museum, which is surprising. And it gets to a big point that you get to in the book. Susan Trollinger, William Trollinger, they're with us. Their book is called Writing America at the Creation Museum, and we need to take another break. But we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Susan Trollinger, William Trollinger. We're talking about their new book, Writing America at the Creation Museum. I want to take a call from Joel, who's been waiting in Spanish Fork, Utah, has what I think is a good question. Joel, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Thanks for having me on. Hey, I teach evolution at UVU. In fact, I'm probably going to be bailing out of here in about 5 minutes to go finish up the chapter on it. And I usually start with Lewis Black's bit where he compares the Creation Museum. He says they're watching the Flintstones as if it were a documentary. And but I move over to say, because we do ridicule. It's kind of what the authors are saying. And I bring up Joseph Campbell's idea of mythology, that we all have our mythology that gives us our place in the universe. For these guys, that's the literal interpretation of Genesis. For scientists like me, that's the Big Bang and natural selection. And I was wondering if they, in asking people to change the mythology, their place in the universe and that internal structure is kind of a heavy lift. And I was wondering if your guests might talk about that.
Good question. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. It is, to use your phrase, it is a heavy lift. That's absolutely right. And that's because I would argue for many fundamentalists and evangelicals in America, the message has been that if you're really going to believe the Bible as the Word of God, as the authority given to us by which we live our lives, then you must believe in this literal understanding of Genesis. And one of the things that I want to stress about our book is that it makes all sorts of sense for us why people might buy into this package that's being sold by young earth creationists like Ken Ham. We understand that. It is hard to give that up. What's disturbing to us is that it would be one thing it would be bad enough maybe, but it would be one thing if we're simply talking about science. But what Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis are selling is more than sort of how we fit in the universe. It's also about how we should structure American society.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's very much a culture war message and not simply a young earth creationist message.
It leads to the question that you get to in the book. What effect is this culture war having? Is it effective in garnering, converts, for example? Ken Ham says to you, he says his dream is to convince millions of ordinary people to reject evolution. So what has the effect of the Answers in Genesis movement, the museum in particular, what effect is it having, do you sense, on the culture?
One of the concerns that we have in looking very closely at the Creation Museum is, and one of the central questions we had is, how does the museum's displays and story, how does it shape how Christians think of themselves and who they ought to be as Christians? And when you move through that narrative, you learn you are positioned in a particular way by the museum in that story, and we find that positioning really troublesome. One of the places where we particularly notice that, and the Ark Encounter, which is opening tomorrow, we expect, we haven't been there yet, we're going tomorrow, but we'll do more of the same, is it positions the visitor in a strange relationship with the whole story of the flood. Mm-hmm. So the flood is crucial for young earth creationists for explaining what looks like an old earth. But it's become increasingly crucial as a theological symbol.
Yeah.
That you have this earth that's populated with all these dreadful sinners. And God is just so fed up, right, with their disobedience that God sees fit, right, to judge them by way of a global flood. But he picks out a few people, right, Noah's family, and says, I'm going to save you. You're the exception. And you take, two of each animal and you all are going to be saved while everyone else perishes. Mm-hmm. The way that the visitor is positioned in the museum with respect to that story is first as kind of an observer of a diorama where the ark is kind of floating off in the distance, and there are mountain peaks. That's all that's left of the earth that's above the floodwaters. Everything else, right, is buried under the water.
Yeah.
And you have people, humans and animals and babies, like trying to climb to the top of this mountain, and they're waving down the ark, come and save us, come and save us. And the ark just flows by, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one scene, right? And so that's a disturbing scene as a Christian to be positioned like, oh my gosh, I could be like one of these people on this rock and I have missed my chance at salvation. Later in that same room, the visitor is positioned in a different way, which we find even more disturbing. And that is they are positioned in the ark.
Yeah.
With Noah's family. And if you look around that room, it is one of the warmest, like in some ways, just at first glance, warmest, most pleasant rooms in the museum. It's all paneled in beautiful golden stained wood. And there are dioramas of, showing the Noah's family, and they're dining together. They're dressed beautifully, tapestries hanging behind them. They're having a lovely meal. They're taking care of the animals. I mean, it's all kinds of beautiful scenes, right? But in this one diorama you have then, so here we are inside the ark, and clearly we are being told that this is a good place to be. And in that scene, you have what the placard tells you below. The door to the ark is open at that time. And God is closing the door to the ark. And when God closes the door, he will not open it again. Mm. So here you are inside the ark. You're looking out this door to the people on the rocks. These, according to AIG, as many as 4 billion people perished in the global flood. And you're inside feeling warm and happy and comfy with Noah's family while potentially billions of people are suffering. So a question that we have is, you know, what does this mean for Christianity in America? It seems like a pretty callous version.
And I should, adding to that, is that Noah's flood prefigures the judgment to come.
Right.
And again, Ken Ham and Answers in Genesis, they're not subtle about this. The judgment is coming. Eternal conscious torment in hell is coming. For all those who do not get on board, in effect. Mm-hmm. And it's not just judgment for individual sinners. It's also judgment for American culture. And they're very explicit about that, that America is under judgment for its abandonment of God's word as the final authority.
If I could just add, you mentioned earlier that there isn't very much Jesus in the museum. Yeah. We believe that that's connected to this point. Jesus is a figure of infinite grace. The story in the Creation Museum, on our read, isn't very much about grace.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you say that, relatively speaking, there's really not much about Jesus' teachings, at least related to compassion, treatment of the poor. You write that in the book, you say that people learned that Jesus performed miracles, and he healed the sick. So we get that part, but apparently he has nothing to teach us about how we should live our lives. That was one of the comments made to you. Explain what's going on there. That idea that, I don't know what, the focus then at least of this group of fundamentalists is less on this idea. And you mentioned a passage in Matthew, a very crucial passage for some Christians, that what really matters is how you treat your fellow human beings. But on some level, the fundamentalists don't seem to be emphasizing that. In fact, that passage in Matthew doesn't seem to apply. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, the passage from Matthew is from Matthew 25, and Jesus is saying, those of you who feed the hungry and take care of the sick and give water to the thirsty and so forth, you are with me, and you will go on to eternal life. And those of you who did not take care of the people at the bottom of society, basically, the people who are struggling, suffering, you are damned. Hmm. But that message, as you rightly point out, is just absent, not only in the museum, but in Answers in Genesis materials. They understand that. They come up with all sorts of ways to understand that passage or reinterpret it or whatever, not being terribly literal, actually. And they also say virtually nothing about Jesus' teachings. One would have to look very hard in Answers in Genesis materials to find anything on Sermon on the Mount. They do not focus on Sermon on the Mount. And in fact, you can, in some Answers in Genesis materials, you get the idea that the only teaching that Jesus ever did is against gay marriage, which actually he didn't teach against gay marriage, but that seems to be the only message from Jesus. So there is a real absence of Jesus in the museum and in Answers in Genesis.
Let me ask you both finally, we have about a minute and a half left or so, because you raised this question, what is the future of this museum? Right now it seems to be thriving pretty well, but you say in the book it's hard to predict whether it's going to survive Ken Ham's lifetime, you know, if it's going to last without his kind of visionary leadership. And it also, Donald Trump comes up, the question of where does Donald Trump fit in all of this? Because you would have thought that if the culture war is thriving, that Ted Cruz would be the presumptive nominee right now. But, you know, is the culture war, in fact, really, I mean, what do you make of the current culture war in the context of someone like Donald Trump leading the Republican Party?
Well, one small point I want to make, and then I want Bill to say something about that, is we do hear striking resonances between the kinds of arguments that Answers in Genesis makes in the Creation Museum and the kinds of arguments that Donald Trump makes.
Huh.
And one of the things is, in the sense that being really cautious about facts or reasoning from a certain piece of evidence to a conclusion is not a top priority. In the book, in the science chapter, we document very carefully their mobilization of evidence and ask questions about whether the supposed plethora of evidence, scientific evidence in the museum actually supports a biblical creation. There's a real looseness about the connection between facts that are mobilized and conclusions that are drawn that we hear elsewhere in American politics.
And one quick thing, they are all the Christian right is more right than Christian. And in that sense, Donald Trump doesn't seem to be posing much of a problem at all.
William Trollinger teaches history at the University of Dayton. Susan Trollinger teaches English there. Their book is called Writing America at the Creation Museum. They joined us from a studio in Dayton. William and Susan, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.